Intervju Radija Študent.
Dan, lep pozdrav terminu za Ereš intervju na Radio, torej na Radio Študent. Danes gostimo Danijela Lopatina alias One of Tricks Point Never. Razlog je pa ta, da danes večer nastopi v klubu K4. Torej, hello Daniel.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us here in our studio.
No problem.
I read that you played the gig last night in Bologna, Italy. Is that so? How did that go?
It was great. It was a very interesting room with, I think it was a 13th century building, had beautiful chandeliers. It was very deep and super resonant, so.
Mm-hmm. I thought that it was a bigger lineup with some other artists.
No. It was just one other act. Mm-hmm.
When you play, usually, you know, these events with more artists, do you get time to see other people playing? I mean, do you enjoy doing that, seeing other people?
Yeah, I do.
Mm.
Yeah.
Was there maybe a recent gig that you really thought that was something special? Something that stuck in your mind?
That's a good question. Not anything lately, but I'm looking forward to my next gig actually.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple days in Manchester, I'm playing with the Hacks and Cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And looking very much forward to that.
Okay. Tonight you're playing at a club called K4 K4. You know, a club that is strongly related to electronic dance music, but lately they're trying to bring in music that isn't strictly related to just dance music. In your collaboration with Joel Ford, you work. Some people see your collaboration as a sort of dance-friendly music. So, you know, I was wondering, what is your relationship with electronic dance music?
My relationship is that I love it. Yeah, for sure. Beyond that, I don't know what to say. I mean, I think right now I'm working on new material.
As one of the tricks?
As one of the tricks that is more maybe in the rhythmic vein of mm-hmm. dance music, but I certainly don't have any prejudices against anything really, so
mm-hmm. Are there any artists in electronic dance music field that you really enjoy?
Oh, lots. Yeah, for sure. We were actually just listening to Hieroglyphic Being coming in,
mm-hmm.
Driving in from Trieste, and it was beautiful. So,
mm-hmm. You know, there was a period in the beginning of the new millennium when lots of producers in this dance-oriented electronic music started using software as opposed to analog synthesizers, and that lasted maybe for 5 years, and then lots of them turned back to analog scenes. Do you think that there's still lots of room for to create, you know, with analog synthesizers. Obviously, I mean, you're still primarily involved with analog synthesizers.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about tools, right? So there's always, like, it would be equivalent to asking if there's still room to use a
guitar.
Or, you know, an oven, a conventional oven for cooking or something. Mm. There definitely is, yeah, sure.
Mm. You know, it seems that your music kind of falls in that gap between strictly club music and, on the other hand, maybe contemporary classical music even. Do you perform maybe in more classical concert venues?
Yeah, it's all dependent on the program, I guess. So, for example, myself and Nate Boyce, who's a sculptor and video artist I work very closely with and is a very good friend of mine, we have been doing a performance called Reliquary House, which is barely music at all, really. It's kind of
more suited for the gallery space, maybe.
Yeah, it's kind of it's almost like a dealing with the materiality of video and sound as an object in a room.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think you will be using video this evening as well. Is that
yeah? And that's Nate. That's Nate Boyce. That's Nate Boyce's reel that he created for me when he can't come.
Mm-hmm.
When he can't come with me.
This is something that came out of this this collaboration with him. I mean, this particular, we were just talking about, or did you work on something new?
No, we've been working together for years now, and he made a few videos for me early on, and we developed Reliquary House out of a very kind of simplistic relationship of me just asking him for videos. At some point, it was kind of boring and tedious, and we decided to work more in a collaborative way, so.
Mm-hmm. If we just go back a little maybe to concert venues, you know, there's infrastructure for club music, infrastructure for classical music, but it seems there's not much of it, at least here in our town or maybe in Europe, for this music that falls in between. And especially nowadays, it seems, you know, one of the more important things for distributing music or getting your music heard is through playing live.
Mm.
So do you see that as a problem, not having as many opportunities to perform live as you could?
It could be a problem, but you know, you do what you can and you survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure.
Do you see this changing maybe in the future? That
I would hope so, but I can't concern myself with those kind of problems. You know, it's a too macro level problem that is above me. I understand the music industry on some level, but at the end of the day, I'm much closer to the music than I am the business, so I don't really know how it works. I don't know exactly what my, you know, depends really on the audience. If a promoter thinks that that he can get that audience, it doesn't matter really what it is, whatever genre it falls between. On the other hand, there's a situation where a lot of promoters just want to hear your music, so they're happy to break even and just to get you to town, and I'm extremely grateful for that because it does happen to me often where you know I can't pack a 700 capacity room, but I can bring 200-300 people, and
you grew up in outside of Boston, then you moved to New York. Was you getting involved in music one of the reasons you moved for to New York? It was No Fun Productions that started releasing your music, and they're based in New York.
In Brooklyn, yeah. What happened was I was in Boston. I was working a super dead end 9-to-5 job that I was just a terrible employee, and so I got fired from that job, and which was good because I didn't like it anyway. And I decided to go to New York to study to become an archivist. That was what I wanted to do. And on some level still kind of feel like is relevant. But anyway, I moved to New York without any pretenses about music. I just wanted to study.
Saying you want to be an archivist, does that mean you collect music as well? Do you have like thousands of records?
No. I've never been like that. I have like six IKEA cubes, and if my records fit into those six, then that's what happens. And if I get more than those six cubes, I have to get rid of stuff. Mm. I actually don't have much room for that kind of thing because I live in New York. I live in a little studio box. Mm. You know, I don't just don't have room for many records. But my archivist compulsion is more about the compulsion. It's about my need to kind of understand where things come from, what the provenance of an object is, and what its history is. It's not as much about the object itself or having it, but about understanding it and trying to trace its history and try to take care of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you moved to New York, obviously you met Carlos Giffoni. Was that before you moved to New York? After that?
Yeah, no, it was, I had moved to New York. Yeah, there was an old noise message board called, I Heart Noise or something, or I can't even remember what it's called anymore, but I wrote him like a private message through the message board because I knew he was posting there, and I sent him my music and he wrote back and said, hey, I love it. Let's mm-hmm. do it.
Were you exposed maybe to any of this sort of music when you were still back in Boston? You know, when you were...
For sure. I was on the floor playing noise shows in basements in Boston and Western Mass. And
so you started more of the noise side of things?
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
Basically, beginning towards kind of the end of 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd been doing it for a while, for mm-hmm. sure.
You know, one of my favorite artists, Keith Fullerton Whitman. You worked with him, I think, or met him for sure. He started quite early on, maybe in early new millennium, first as Hrvatski, then started this more drone stuff. And he really caught my attention, so I started following this more drone-y synth kind of music.
Yeah.
And he's from Boston as well.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of... something that you could call a scene?
Absolutely. The story I tell, basically, without becoming too verbose about it, is when I was in college, I was in Western Massachusetts, and it was during Freak Folk, mm-hmm. and I couldn't get a gig. I was like begging people to let me play, but it just, what I was doing was out of fashion.
Is it fashionable now?
No, I don't know. It was for a couple of years. I don't know. Things go in and out of fashion. I just kind of do what mm-hmm. I was doing. But anyway, I moved to Boston, and there wasn't really a style that was prevalent in Boston, you know, but it was had the right environment. People were open-minded, and there was Keith, his shop, Mimaroglu, mm-hmm. Really great record stores like Twisted Village and now Weirdo. And Weirdo was around then too. Guys like Howie Stelzer, Brendan Murray. Oh God, there's just so many great musicians. But
gigs were happening regularly.
Yeah, but they were like pop up gigs wherever, basements. You know, mm-hmm. college kids would, you know, move in and out of Boston in 4-year increments. But while they were there, there would be shows and pop-up venues and basements and stuff like that. We just did it. I mean, Boston was always rich for, you know, punk and hardcore, and mm-hmm. It's a great place for music. It's a great place for music.
Mm-hmm. Do you still go back to Boston?
Yeah. My folks live outside of Boston, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
So, speaking of your folks, your mother was a classical pianist. Your father played in, I think, in various bands.
Yeah.
And he introduced you to synthesizers, or maybe gave you even your first synthesizers. You're probably exposed to some quite interesting music through your parents as well.
Yeah, for sure.
When you were growing up.
Yeah. I was exposed to an attitude of listening and openness to, in general. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, my mother would play Chopin on piano and I would listen. My sister was great, a great piano player when I was young, and I would listen to them. And of course, my father listened to, you know, rock records and whatever, and kind mm-hmm. of, there was it was encouraged. And
when did you get, when did you get first in touch with this more experimental side of music?
I think,
this tape music?
Honestly, without sounding like mythologizing myself, honestly, I was always very drawn to things going on around the notes. So I caught, like, even as a little kid, like, George Martin tricks on Sgt. Pepper or whatever were super appealing to me. Mm-hmm. Or, like, the kind of strange passages in A Day in a Life or something. Or the crazy keyboard, you know, synth sections on Stevie Wonder records and mm-hmm. jazz fusion tapes that my dad had was a really good collection of jazz fusion tapes. And I fell in love with all that crazy kind of just textural stuff.
Right.
And it wasn't until later that I understood how to make it or what the tools were. For a long time, it was just like magic. It might as well have been this mystical thing. I just had no idea how anyone could possibly make it. Mm. So, yeah.
Maybe going back to Keith Fullerton Whitman just for a second. One of my favorite records in this kind of music is his Multiplus, which was released maybe 7 years ago or so. Mm. And I think that he recorded most of it in Harvard University studios, where they keep these really rare old synthesizers. I imagine that, you know, for someone like him or you who are really into synthesizer, it must be like letting a kid into a candy store or to get access to all those.
Certainly, Keith. I'm not as much of a synth connoisseur as it may seem I am. Mm-hmm. I kind of...
Because I know you have a special relationship with Judy.
Yeah, I have a special relationship with Judy, and...
Is it still a monogamous relationship?
No, it was actually never monogamous, but she was my favorite. But, you know, Keith is somebody that understands synthesis on such a high level that for him it must be unbelievable getting access to those machines. Whereas you put me in front of, like, a sophisticated or archaic modular synthesizer, and I understand the basic concepts, but I don't think on a high level like mm-hmm. that. My music, it tends to be more about abstraction, or it's less formalist, or has been formalistic to this point. Mm-hmm. So it's not really about process.
In a way, it seems more structured. Like,
it's structured in its own way, for sure, but it's not because I'm a good synthesist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rifts was the album that really kind of meant a breakthrough for you. Mm. And it's basically a compilation of your older songs. You know, how come you decided to put out a compilation? Was there a particular plan behind that?
It was Carlos. The first thing I sent Carlos was new material. It was a record called Russian Mind. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, what else do you have? And so I started feeding him stuff that had already been on tapes, or, you know, I had a record on Arbor Records called Zones Without People. So I started giving him everything I had, and he was like, and this stuff belongs together. It's like a suite of music. It's definitely tied together. It's holistic. So we did the CD to kind of, it was like a primer. It was like a way for people that had missed the small editions, the small run tape editions, to get everything easily.
Carlos releases, you know, music by quite high-profile artists on his label, but artists that are mostly known within a certain scene. But you were exposed then to a bit wider audience. Were you surprised by how well the Rifts was received?
No, I wasn't surprised, because, you know, I'm primarily, like, what I liked about noise and free music was structurally interesting things you could do to create a kind of a framework for sound. But my nature is to write melody, and I think melodically, and I think about music in terms of more or less kind of like euphonic structure. Mm. So was I surprised? I mean, I'm always surprised that anybody likes anything I do, but not because of that. You know, I'm surprised because I have low self-esteem, but not because I, you know, not because right. of the difficulty or ease of those pieces.
And getting rejected, one of your songs you made for that compilation of Philip Glass.
Yeah, that was blown out of proportion a little bit.
It didn't help your self-esteem.
No, I don't care. It was more like, I did a show with DJ Rupture on WFMU in New Jersey, and he asked me to bring some stuff that was rare, stuff that hadn't been heard or whatever, so I threw that in there. And he asked me why I didn't make it, and I just said that I assume that it's because it wasn't good enough. That was it. So it's no hair off my back. It wasn't meant to be like a...
Did you maybe hear that compilation yet? Because I think it was just released, maybe.
No, I haven't heard it. No, I wasn't the only person. You know, there were other people that also didn't make it to, you know, whatever. So it's fine.
I wrote down some names that did make it. You know, it was still on the Braxton, No Such Thing, Dan Dico, Neymon Tobin, Beck, Jochen Jochensson. You like these people's music? Enjoy any
Let's
of these?
Let's look at these. Yeah, some of these are my buddies.
I really enjoy
Tiandai. I'm just starting to listen to some of his stuff. I'm not too familiar, but it seems interesting.
He incorporates this more pop side of music into classical music, or the other way around. So
yeah, that's
quite interesting.
It's very New York. You know, I had Bricolage when I was a kid, when I was in high school. Yeah, you know, I mean, I generally like things. And don't hate things, so yeah, I'm sure there's good stuff.
You said that you were happy with that song you made for this compilation, and do you think it will see the light of day someday?
It doesn't matter. It was just an exercise. Remixes are to me, are just kind of, they can be more than just an exercise, but that for me was an exercise. And perhaps it wasn't, you know, it's definitely not my best remix, but, you know.
Which do you consider to be your best remix?
My best remix? Oh man, there's a couple I really like. I did one for Ganja Sufi that I loved. It was like the first remix I ever did. It was super sloppy, but I loved it.
How were you approached to do that remix?
I honestly can't remember. It probably Warp asked me.
Do you see maybe yourself releasing a record on Warp Records?
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps.
Do you perhaps working on some new material?
Yeah. Yeah.
For a full album?
Yeah. Hopefully like two or three albums of stuff to pick from. This is as a really good time for me. I was as creative as I've felt in years. And I'm very excited to record again.
Well, we're excited to hear that.
Thanks.
So maybe just a couple more questions about your live show.
Sure.
Has it changed much since the beginning when you started?
Yeah, for sure. Basically, the live show I did for years was basically a kind of like a drone show using a synth and some loopers and layering loops.
Is that something like that was released on that Synth Night record?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sure.
It was more abstract kind of.
Yeah, that was a live show, yeah. Yeah, it was generally like that. But with every record, I tend to have a different set of instruments or whatever. So what's working for me now is a combination of software and a outboard sampler. And kind of employing some of the same structural techniques or whatever. But generally, I'm not interested in just like straight droning out and looping for... you know, 15 minutes in a row, whatever.
Right. So it's kind of, I mean, if you compare your music to some other people that are interested in this similar kind of music, like Keith Fullerton Whitman, he made quite a few shorter songs in the past, but now it seems he's more into these longer songs that really develop, and it seems like an exploration in sound and... but you are sticking with this shorter structure, like more even pop in a way.
Yeah, especially I'm going more and more. I'm interested right now in plasticity and things morphing and generating variety in short spurts. So that's definitely where I'm at right now, but, you know, that's subject to change.
So maybe just one more question. You said that you, in a few days you're playing in Manchester. Are you on some tour at the moment?
Or it's just a very short tour. Just I came primarily to Europe to play at Unsound with Tim Hacker in a duo.
we had Tim Hacker here in the studio.
Oh, nice.
A few years ago, yeah, really nice.
He's a great guy. Mm. So, yeah, I'm doing a few. I did Bologna, as you mentioned, Ljubljana tonight, Manchester.
Mm-hmm. I know that you worked with Tim on a record.
Yes.
Are you maybe planning a collaboration in the future? Another collaboration?
Well, we're embarking on our first live show next week.
Uh-huh. Oh, so at You Sound you perform together?
Together. So,
And how does that maybe compare to your solo live performance?
Very different. It actually harkens back to my older style. There's no sampling involved. It's all just keyboards and playing. Mm-hmm. So, it's much more similar to maybe the way I kind of improvised 2-3 years ago.
But you still feel closer to this more shorter structure.
For my own music, yeah, because I'm, you know, with your own stuff, you're selfish and you want to explore the things you want to explore. But in this context with Tim, it's so, there couldn't be another way. It's perfect. It's a shared language. And it's so freeing and it's so refreshing after, you know, I've been playing the same tunes for the past year or so, since November or something. So you get to a level of tedium with some of the music, and this feels like such a nice way to perform, because it's not tied too closely to a particular tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay, sounds excellent. So,
right.
Thank you very
thanks,
much for
yeah, thanks
joining
very much.
Us. To je bil torej Daniel Lopatin, ki ga danes večer, torej Daniel Lopatin ali As One Trix Point Never, ki bo danes večer nastopil v klubu K4. Intervju sem pripravil Goran, lep pozdrav.
Intervju Radija Študent.